Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, we're going to take a look at political chaos in Victoria. It's engulfing both the major parties. The Labor Premier has been referred to the anti-corruption watchdog over the state's big build scandal, and the Liberal Party is once again in disarray as one MP launches a legal challenge, all with an election less than 150 days away. You're going to hear from Victoria's Shadow Attorney General.
If you're saying to me, should the Liberal Party be elected at every election forevermore, I agree with you.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
What you're asking me is, should the Liberal Party have won every past election?
I'm asking why you've been unable to do that.
I am hoping that at this election, Victorians realise the need to clean up this state.
Then, two far-right leaders in Europe are vowing to fight consequential elections. We'll find out what's going on with Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. It's good to be back with you on The Breakfast Wrap. Big thank you to Brooke Young for jumping in over the last couple of days, covering some of the biggest stories around the world. Today, though, we're going to take a look back home and look to the next election Australia faces. Not the federal election, but a state one. It will be in Victoria in November. And less than 150 days out, both the major parties are in a bit of strife. It's not really new for the Liberal Party in Victoria, but for the Labor Party, it's been in government for more than a decade, and the latest scandal is threatening to be its undoing. The state opposition has referred Premier Jacinta Allen to the state's anti-corruption watchdog. It comes as the fallout from the big build corruption scandal continues, where an estimated $15 billion of taxpayer funds reportedly went to bikies who infiltrated the CFMEU. It's something the Premier has been asked about in press conferences, is what she said yesterday, reiterating her concerns about misconduct.
I have been clear for more than 2 years now. These reports, and some of them I do want to be careful because police are investigating and we shouldn't cut across that very serious and important work. But there has been examples of extreme and violent behaviour and I've been clear of that.
That is the Victorian Labor Premier, Jacinta Allen there. Well, on the other side of politics is James Newbury. He's a Liberal MP, he's also the Shadow Attorney General, and he came on with Sally this morning to talk about the Premier and also the problems facing his own Liberal Party.
You've referred the Premier to IBAC, the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission. What personal responsibility do you believe she has on this issue?
The Premier, when she was then Minister, reportedly intervened in a dispute between the union and another company. As a result of that intervention, the CFMEU's preferred company got a particular contract for a level crossing removal project job. And since, that company has been charged with serious financial crimes and police allege them to be corrupt. So allegedly, had the Premier's office not intervened, that company that has since been charged would not have got that job. So it is very, very serious a set of allegations. And sadly, since these allegations came to light, every time the Premier's been asked about them, she said she hasn't even bothered to check her records.
The Premier has apologised for the cost of this big build scandal to taxpayers last week. Is that sufficient until voters can make up their own minds in the state election in November?
I don't think she actually did apologise for that. I do accept that she said sorry for something. When questioned, she couldn't actually explain what she was sorry for. I think the only thing she's sorry for is the fact there's an election coming and voters think that she's responsible for the worst corruption scandal the state's ever seen. I don't think she actually has apologised for anything specifically, which is the point. The only way we will stop what is occurring is through a royal commission and getting tough, which is what we're proposing to do if we're elected.
What do you believe misconduct around the big build has cost the state of Victoria?
Well, we've seen obviously reports of at least $15 billion, up to $30 billion. So we don't know, but we need to understand why and the full cost, which is why we've committed to a very strong royal commission. We want to also chase down the money. We want to chase down criminals and chase down money. And you will hear the Premier say police are investigating, but we're yet to see anyone convicted of anything or any money come back to the state that has been corrupted. I mean, everyone is getting off scot-free.
Moira Deeming has accused a former opposition leader and fellow MP Matthew Guy of assaulting her. A police looked at the footage and said no offence could be detected. The Liberal Party was set to disendorse her this week, but now she's launched legal action effectively halting this. When you're trying to hold the government to account, how damaging and distracting is all this to the Liberal Party and your chances to take back power in November?
Well, this is a matter before the court, so of course you'll understand why it would be inappropriate for me to comment. But that in no way detracts from me working 7 days a week, as is the rest of my team. We are going to make sure that Victorians understand the importance of this election. They understand that corruption is infesting the state. I mean, I often say it's the worst example in our state's history, and I think that that's probably an accepted fact.
So if all this is going on, why is the Liberal Party involved again in infighting and legal cases?
Well, I wouldn't characterise it that way. You've referred to one particular matter relating to one particular person, and that is a matter before the court. So, of course, I wouldn't comment on that. But you've asked me about my day job and what we are doing as a team. Well, I'll tell
no,
you what
I didn't
I'm
ask
doing.
You that. I didn't ask well, you that. Well, what
well,
do you make
you
of
asked
the?
Me whether I'm focused. Whether I'm focused. Well, I'll tell you I'm focused, and I'll tell you what I'm focused on.
No,
I'm
I asked if it was damaging and distracting to the party's chances of taking back power in November.
And I'm telling you, every single day, I am prosecuting what this government is doing wrong, because Victorians need to know, and we need to fix it. We need to clean up this state.
If this Labor government in Victoria is as bad as the way in which you're characterising it, why has the Liberal Party been unable to throw this government out at the ballot box?
Well, because the election's in November. I mean, you can't throw a government out
over several years. The Labor government's been in for some time. Why has...
Well, the big build... I mean, if you're talking about corruption and the big build...
No, that wasn't what I was asking again.
But if I can give you an example, the issue of corruption and the big build has come to light over the last couple of years. So since that time, the first election to occur is in November. And I think that the state Labor government's going to be wiped out.
Was it a bad government before that on issues of COVID and so on?
Well, my view is this government's been a bad government and shouldn't have been elected in the first place. Of course, I've never voted for them. But
I'm asking is, why is the Liberal Party unable to win elections and get Labor out, who've been in for some time now and faced criticism for their handling of the state, the state's economy, issues like COVID and now big bill?
Look, firstly, we live in a democracy, so everyone has a right. If you're saying to me, should the Liberal Party be elected at every election forevermore? I agree with you.
Not what I'm saying.
What you're asking me is, should the Liberal Party have won every past election?
I'm asking you why you've been unable to do that.
What I'm saying is, in a democracy, different parties win over time. I am hoping that at this election, Victorians realise the need to clean up this state, which is exactly the argument that we're putting, because it's time to fix this state and to clean it up.
James Newbury there, a Liberal MP and the Victorian Shadow Attorney General. Well, we get Tom Crowley to talk about all sorts of things. He's usually stationed in Parliament House talking federal politics. But for the next little while, I'm fortunate to be sharing my Melbourne studio with him. So, of course, we had to get him on to talk about Victorian politics. And here's what he had to say with Sally about that interview.
Yes, it was a bit of an entertaining exchange and worth going back to, especially if you are a Victorian. I mean, the key question here, the main thing you were talking about was the CFMEU corruption, which is a massive issue now for Jacinta Allen, whose personal numbers are you know, absolutely in the toilet. But this Victorian government has had its detractors for a long time. And as you got into with James Newbury, not only has the Liberal Party not been able to win elections, they've actually lost ground in terms of seats, or at least Labor's gained ground in terms of seats in every single election. Labor went forward by one in the 2022 election after the bruising experience of the pandemic. It's been a revolving door of leaders for the Liberal Party. There continue to be melodramas relating to Moira Deeming and others within the party. Now Jess Wilson sits in polling. She's the only major party leader, with Pauline Hanson as the proxy for no One Nation Victorian leader. Jess Wilson, the only one with a positive approval rating in the latest Redbridge poll. But how's this for primaries? One Nation 27, Labor 26, and the Coalition 26. That is basically a three-way tie in the margin for error of these polls heading into the election. It's a very hard one to read. One Nation doesn't even have a leader in the state of Victoria yet, and yet they are still polling as number one. So that's its own quite extraordinary thing. It's going to be a really fascinating election.
Yeah, it is. And momentum seems to be building, so to speak, around the big build controversy as well, and pushing for more answers there.
Sally Sara and Tom Crowley there with a bit of analysis on Victorian politics. Well, we're going to turn to Europe now, where two far-right leaders are promising to pursue their political ambitions despite increasing scrutiny over how they've been handling allegedly fraudulent finances. The two leaders we're talking about are France's Marine Le Pen and the UK's Nigel Farage. We're going to first dive into the leader of the far-right Reform Party, Mr. Farage, because he's saying this morning that he is resigning his seat in the UK Parliament to stand again. This while he faces scrutiny over donations.
Enough is enough. And I thought over the weekend, what shall I do? I could go out and try and make some real big money. I could go to the USA. And then I thought, why should I be judged today or in history in the future by Sky News and their ilk? Why should they be the people that decide my fate when, as I repeat, I've done nothing wrong?
So Mr. Farage denies wrongdoing. He says that he'll let his constituents be his judges, but his political opponents say that the by-election is fake and a circus. The Spectator's political correspondent, Noah Hoffman, has been following this story, and she spoke to Sally this morning.
What has Nigel Farage decided to do here?
He's decided that he wants to get on the front foot of this issue of gifts he's received in the past and whether or not he should have declared them. There's currently an investigation by the House of Commons sleaze watchdog into whether Farage broke parliamentary procedure by not declaring all the gifts he's received. He wanted to get ahead of that investigation, which could have resulted in him in a by-election being triggered, by triggering one himself. However, this sort of clever move, which Reform thought was quite smart on their part, has somewhat backfired because all of the mainstream parties in the UK are saying they aren't going to field candidates for this race and they aren't going to take part in what they call a stunt and his antics. So it's all quite messy here.
Take us back to these donations. We're talking about millions of pounds. Who are the largest donors who have given money to Nigel Farage?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astonishing. So the largest donor is a man by the name of Christopher Harborne. He's a British Thai crypto billionaire. And he gave Farage a £5 million gift, which Reforms say was unconditional and personal in nature and therefore not needed to be declared, before Farage stood to be an MP. However, it was within the 12-month period before he stood in the 2024 general election and therefore comes within the purview of gifts that require declaring. He didn't declare that gift, saying it wasn't necessary because of its personal nature. The media here got a hold of that information, put it out to the public, and ever since that story came out a few months ago, he's really been very tetchy. He's sort of stopped all his press conferences, which he loved doing, and he's been very frustrated and sort of dipping in momentum as well.
What are we seeing with the results in opinion polls at the moment? Because obviously in another very high-profile by-election, Andy Burnham got up, but is there still that residual support for reform?
So Reform has been pretty consistent between about 25 and 30% in the polls, which is the highest polling of all the parties. What we're seeing at the moment in the UK is very much a breakdown of the traditional two-party system of Labour versus the Tories and the rise of populist parties with Reform on the right and the Greens on the left. The Greens in the UK are a bit more outlandish than they are in Australia. And so he's been consistent in that sort of territory, but he hasn't been able to come above it and grab onto those undecideds or those more centrist traditional Tory voters who can't sort of stomach the idea of voting Reform. And if he really wanted to win a sort of stonking parliamentary majority, he does need to grasp onto more of those voters. And then, of course, you mentioned Andy Burnham, who is very likely to be the next prime minister after Sir Keir Starmer in just a few weeks' time. He has an appeal that Starmer didn't have to the sort of traditional white working class voters tempted by Farage and by Reform. And that really came to the forefront in the by-election that facilitated Burnham's return to Parliament. Now, in Clacton, which is Farage's current seat, Labour do not have a chance. It is staunchly right-wing. If anything, the Tories are the challenger party there. However, they have ruled out standing a candidate, saying they're not going to take part in a gimmick.
The Spectator's political correspondent, Noah Hoffman, there, speaking to Sally all the way from London. We're going to stay in Europe, but we're going to head across the channel now, where political analyst Dominique Moisy has been following another story. The leader of France's far-right National Rally Party, Marine Le Pen, has declared that she'll run for president next year, but her path remains pretty treacherous. Overnight, a Paris appeals court upheld her conviction for embezzling millions of euros of European Parliament funds, but it shortened her ban on running for office. It's suspended a portion of her jail sentence too. Speaking on French TV earlier this morning, Ms. Le Pen maintained her innocence and announced that she would take the case to the country's highest court.
I had indicated that I would not campaign while wearing an electronic tag, but since I have the option of appealing and the government is suspending the effects of the ruling, I will therefore campaign without an electronic tag. So tonight, I am a candidate in the presidential election.
And that is Marine Le Pen, France's National Rally Party leader. So from Paris, Dominique Moisy told Sally what the verdict actually means for French politics.
It's a very sophisticated result. On the one hand, it confirms the condemnation of Marine Le Pen. But on the other hand, the new verdict allows her to run as a candidate, even if on paper she would have to run with an electronic bracelet as someone who has been condemned, but whose ineligibility has been greatly reduced. So it's quite casuistic, but Marine Le Pen took one conclusion from it. I can run, and I will run, as the candidate of the National Rally.
How is this decision being received publicly in France?
It's a huge bet for the National Rally. On the left and on the centre-right, those who oppose Marine Le Pen are saying, well, we're not going to vote for someone who's been condemned by justice. But the electorate of Marine Le Pen, that is a very strong electorate, may decide that, well, it doesn't matter.
Marine Le Pen was convicted of embezzling 1.4 million euros in European Parliament funds to pay her own party employees between 2004 and 2016. That was upheld. Can you remind our listeners what happened?
She used the money that was given to her as a member of the European Parliament to pay her national employees, so to speak. So there was a misuse of the fund.
What do you think this decision means for Marine Le Pen's electoral prospects? Will it affect it badly?
Well, first, she's going to run together with Bardella they are presenting themselves as a team. When Marine Le Pen says, vote for me, it means vote also for Bardella. I will be the president. He will be my prime minister. I mean, for the first time in the history of the Fifth Republic, the chances of Marine Le Pen party to come to power are real. It's a huge bet. In a way, the decision will depend upon the opponent. If the moderates are divided, it leaves the extreme left, LFI, Mélenchon, a very good card to play. And if in the second round you see the extreme right opposing the extreme left, well, the extreme right will come to power.
A good little look into French politics with political analyst Dominique Moisy. Well, there's been plenty of coverage this week about the Prime Minister's meetings with Pacific leaders, now up against the backdrop of that Chinese missile test in the Pacific. Anthony Albanese is today holding meetings with his counterparts from Papua New Guinea and Tonga in Brisbane before they watch the Rugby League State of Origin decider. He's back in Australia after signing the Vivale Union Security and Development Pact while visiting Fiji and also joining Independence Day celebrations in Solomon Islands. The ANU's distinguished fellow, James Batley, was once the Australian High Commissioner there, also the High Commissioner to Fiji. He gave us his assessment over the last few days of diplomacy.
To my mind, it's been a pretty emphatic consolidation of Australia's position as the key security partner of Pacific Island countries. It's been, really big wins for Australian diplomacy in the region.
The PM signed historic treaties with Fiji this week, the Vivale Union and also this Ocean of Peace Alliance. You were High Commissioner there previously. Are these landmarks in the relationship?
They certainly are. When I was in Fiji, of course, that was following the 2006 military coup, so we had a pretty bad relationship with the regime of then Prime Minister Bainimarama. So this is really a complete turnaround from those days. But it really underlines, I think, the sense of trust that has been built up between Pacific Island countries and Australia.
China's test firing of this missile this week, do you think it has added to a sense of momentum of Australia's political efforts in the Pacific, or could it scare off some of the Pacific nations who may be reluctant to become closer strategically, politically, and from a security perspective with Australia?
No, I don't think it will have won China any friends at all. I do think there is an evolution in the way that Pacific Island countries are thinking about China. A few years ago, I think it was a much more straightforward idea that geostrategic competition is quite good because it can be leveraged to get more aid, more development assistance. I think now there's a much more realistic appreciation that the stakes are pretty high, and that Chinese behaviour really can destabilise the region. I think we'll see a continuation of this sort of Jekyll and Hyde aspect of Chinese approaches where, on the one hand, there's a charm offensive, but on the other hand, there are these really intimidatory gestures that we see occasionally.
We need to talk football, James. The Prime Minister will meet the PNG Prime Minister James Marape in Brisbane today, and the government's investment in a new NRL team in Papua New Guinea will be on the agenda. How do you see the use of soft power in this area?
Yeah, look, I think like a lot of people, I'm a little bit ambivalent about this. It's a lot of money. But I think on balance, it is a worthwhile investment from Australia. I think the soft power benefits, they're very hard to measure, but I think they're worth the investment. And I think it will go a long way to build those people-to-people links between Australia and not just Papua New Guinea, but other countries in the region.
And that is the ANU's distinguished fellow, James Batley, the former High Commissioner to Solomon Islands, also to Fiji, speaking to Sally Sara about the Prime Minister's diplomacy this week. Well, thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Kathy Van Extel. I'm Luke Sidham-Dunton. I'll see you tomorrow.